Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
I was talking yesterday or on Saturday with Nolan Bushnell, who's the founder of Atari. He's been involved in founding, I think, something like 100 companies. You know, I was talking to him and he's like, it is so weird, right? This is the most technical guy on the planet, right? And he's like, I don't program anymore. I don't have to write code anymore. It's all there. I just click it together. What does that mean? Like, when you don't have to be like a Nolan level technologist to build Nolan level technologies. I mean, that's mind blowing. And that's the world that we're moving into. And that's why we've got to have these bigger picture skills. Technology is a democratizing force. And what that means is that the capabilities of people at the next level up are suddenly, you know, devolved. But that also means that the decision-making skills of kings, you know, of global leaders, they now need to be pushed down, you know, deeper into our organizations, deeper into our societies.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Jonathan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks so much for having me. I can't wait to get into this.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about you by way of your publicist, and I know that you have a new book out called Rogue Waves, Future Proof Your Business, Survive and Profit from Radical Change, all of which we will get into. But before we do that, I want to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that influenced and shaped what you ended up doing with your life and your career?
I've thought a lot about this. I had a difficult relationship with my father. And what I realized, you know, maybe in my 30s, was that what he was trying to teach me, the one thing he was trying to teach me, was to push harder than I know how, to go to new places and to try new things. And that's driven my life in a really powerful ways.
I mean, so, you know, specifically, like, how, you know, did that impact, you know, the choices that you've made, you know, from high school to, you know, college to career and beyond?
That's a great question. Almost everything I've done has been moving into a new territory, figuring out what can and can't happen there, rapidly decreasing risk and helping either organizations I'm leading or organizations that I'm advising do things that wouldn't be possible without that repeated knowledge of walking into the unknown and figuring out how to walk out the other side.
Yeah. I mean, did your parents, you know, give you any particular career advice or suggest any career paths? Because, you know, as a joke before, Indian parents were like, all right, what's it going to be, doctor, lawyer, or engineer?
Right. They were really open on it, actually. They really wanted me to find my own path. At one point, my father, I'd wanted to join my father's business and he wouldn't let me. He wanted me to really find my own way, which I think was very powerful. And they were... very open to kind of where I've gone, which is this world of sitting in between strategy and enterprise risk management and big picture thinking, being a public intellectual, and at the same time getting down on the ground and dirty and actually building things and playing with engineers and scientists and sitting on manufacturing floors. You know, it's what I do is a pretty rare thing, which is helping organizations think about their big picture future, but in ways that really allow them to get down to the granularity of what's actually possible, right? Can we actually, you know, we have this big picture idea of, as executives, but can we actually, you know, implement this, you know, on the shop floor in China in 2 years, right? What's that balance between vision and reality?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that he taught you to push harder than you ever thought you could. And one thing I wonder about that is, how much of that do you think is innate, and how much of that do you think is something that can be cultivated and learned?
I don't know. I feel like he was always concerned that I wouldn't be self-motivated. And when I look inside of large organizations, what I discover is that, you know, a lot of people are externally motivated. I'm completely driven by my own interests and my own beliefs. And so it's an interesting thing to ask about. I'm not sure. You know, I think that pushing in the way that I do certainly creates a lot of personal stress and a lot of unnecessary, you know, pain for me. That other people who might not be so self-motivated or is highly motivated, you know, that they don't have to go through. So
yeah,
I think there are two answers to the question, right? The first is, how do you increase that desire? And then the second is that a good idea? It's been a good idea for me.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's a good idea for everyone.
Well, I want to come back to that whole idea of being driven by self-interest. But one thing you mentioned also was this idea of venturing into the unknown. And one of the things that I have noticed, you know, as a byproduct of interviewing people on this show, you know, through my own creative work and through the thousands of people that I've spoken to over probably the last 10 years, is that, you know, tolerance for risk seems to be one of those things that is instrumental to every single outcome in your life. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, we, you know, don't learn in childhood that pretty much determines everything in adulthood. You know, if you want to get married, you take the risk of asking somebody out on a date. If you want to get a job, you take the risk of applying, knowing that you might get rejected. But one thing that happens, I think, is that our tolerance for risk, as we get older, for good reason in many cases, starts to go down. But you seem to be a person who basically helps people not only manage risk, but also take risks. Because I know you mentioned, you know, making bold bets in the book, you know, later on, which we'll get into. How do you bring that back when you're older without, you know, losing your mind?
This is a great question and something I'm going through as we speak. I think there are two sides of risk taking, right? Or of risk, right? There's the threat and there's the opportunity. And the question becomes, how do you link those two? How do you use your understanding of probability, or that the way that probability is distributed in the situation you're in today, to make a bigger bet while actually taking lower risk, right? The way that you know, if you spend time in casinos, you know, what you rapidly learn is that the your strategy at the poker table is different than your strategy at the roulette table. And what you want to do is really step back and make sure you understand the rules of the game before you play it. You want to make sure you pick the right strategy. And as you get older, I think that's the thing you get better at doing, is, you know, through the you know, training, you know, what you can do in book learning and repeated success and failure, you know, you learn how to take these bigger bets with lower risk. And I think that's the key, is learning that skill of metacognition, right? What do we know about what's in front of us? How do we move from kind of the two-dimensional view of the playing field to a more three-dimensional view?
Mm-hmm.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting you brought that up because there's, you know, one quote in particular that, you know, struck me, which will, you know, make a perfect transition to talk about the book. And it was about, you know, the financial investment in higher education and whether or not it makes sense anymore. Because, you know, I went to college in 1996 at Berkeley, where there's no question that, you know, a college degree from a school like that was going to open doors. And that whole narrative has changed substantially over the last decade. And given the work that you do, given that you're really a futurist, when you think about education in particular, you know, for people who are listening to this who are parents who have children, what would you say to them? Like, what are the things they need to be thinking about in terms of preparing their kids for the future of the workforce?
I think there are three things to be really taking into consideration, right? The first is the importance of the social network. Right now, we're in this Zoom world where for some reason we believe that you can get things done with people you don't know in high-risk situations on Zoom. You take a look at a company like Amazon. Amazon Web Services, they're supposed to grow 70% this year. The people who are doing that 70% growth, they've never met each other. Now, how do you take high risk without ever having actually spent time together. You know, I think about, and I think that's one of the things that college, especially elite universities, do is they create those lifelong social bonds. I think that's really important. At the end of the day, right, the Enlightenment can say whatever they want. We're still animals. And I know what happens when my dog looks at my iPad and she gets interested for about 30 seconds and walks away. You know, if we can't somehow sniff each other's butts, right, like that link doesn't happen in the same kind of way. I think that's a really important first point. The second point is around cultural pieces. So since the end of World War II, right, culture is really centered around the United States. You know, globally, it's been the dominant culture. Moving into 2030, I think one of the real questions is, does it continue to be, as you start to see, you know, it's slowed down probably, but as you start to see the continued rise of the middle class in China, the continued rise of the middle class in Southeast Asia, and obviously, you know, the explosion in India, right? What's really clear to me is that global culture is moving from West to East. Are your people, are your kids, are they preparing for that? Are they building into that way of looking at the world, that way of doing things? Because if they aren't, if they can't transition between the two worlds, they're going to have a real problem moving forward. And then the third piece is about technical skills, right? We get so obsessed with STEM and like, are our kids learning how to program? And, you know, we're seeing the, you know, the death knell of liberal arts degrees and all of this stuff. And what we forget is that as you start to see the explosion of neural nets, as you start to see the explosion of automation, you know, many of the technical things that we learn in school become irrelevant. One of my mentors, Marvin Minsky, who was one of the fathers of artificial intelligence, he said to our class one day, you know, what's the most useless degree on the planet? A degree in computer science. By definition, it will be completely degraded by the time you leave. And so the question is, why do you want a computer science degree from MIT? And the answer is they aren't teaching you how to code. They're teaching you what's called epistemology. They're teaching you the study of knowledge, how to know new things. And there are really four major ways that we do that. And we talk about them in the book. And we kind of hide this because it's super geeky. But there's deductive thinking, right? This is what a lawyer does. There's in, which is like, how do you take the known universe of facts and work through logic to figure out what's true? The second is inductive thinking. This is how a scientist works, right? Given all of the body of knowledge that's available, what's most likely, right? So one is absolute truth, one is likelihood. The third is abductive thinking. So this is like what Sherlock Holmes does, right? And he says, okay, so we have all of these facts on the table. I've done those first two things. But what if some of those facts turn out to be not true? Or what if other information came to light? How would that change my opinion? Right. So he's starting to look at counterfactual issues. And then the fourth is what's called Bayesian reasoning. And this is the idea that we can stack up probabilities. And through logic, we can say, okay, well, if this thing's 10% true to 40% true, and this thing's 30% to 20% true or whatever, and we link these things all together, you know, what happens? What's the aggregate of all of these? What's the range of possibility if we kind of push and pull all these levers? And that's how you do things like a lot of things like climate modeling. It's how a lot of artificial intelligence works. And that's the fourth major skill. And so what you're trying to teach your kids in school is how to learn how to do those four things. Because those are the base skills, everything else, right? We talked a lot about soft skills, right? How do you work in different cultures? How do you make sure that you know the right people? How do you learn to network? But the second thing is, how do you learn to learn? And that's going to be the most important skill of the next decade. And I get really concerned when we start talking about STEM and all of this stuff, and how we don't need liberal arts. You know, what we've got to remember is mathematics is a branch of philosophy, right? Epistemology is a branch of philosophy. The way we teach philosophy, right, is both through philosophy class and some through coding and programming and whatnot, but also by reading Shakespeare, right? By learning about how other people have dealt with learning history, by learning about how other people have dealt with the unknown. And I think we're at a huge risk today as we start trying to get our kids to be more technical and start trying to turn, you know, liberal arts schools like Stanford into computer science trade schools, that we aren't generating the next big leaders. We're generating a nation of small leaders.
You know, it's funny you brought up the sort of degree becoming obsolete, because I was, you know, at Berkeley between 1996 and 2000. And, you know, for the most part, everybody's computer science degree was outdated by the time they graduated. I mean, just to, you know, give people an idea of how different the world was at the time, you know, a lot of the tech companies in the Bay Area would come to recruit computer science students from Berkeley. And there was one company who never had anybody at their table, Apple, which is absurd to think now. But, you know, I think the thing that I started to see over the last 20 years or so is, as a non-computer science person who, you know, wanted to do all sorts of things, was this sort of gap between creativity and technology that started to become narrower and narrower. You know, I just got the new iPhone 13 and I could not believe the things that it's capable of in terms of video. You know, I remember Elisa Gansky, who founded Ophoto, told me it took $100 million in funding to build Ophoto. Now a kid could sit on their laptop over the course of a weekend and build that at home. And, you know, Julian Smith, who's a founder of Breather, has, you know, been a guest here. He told me the thing that you should always be asking yourself is, what does this make possible that wasn't before? And I started to just notice that it's no longer, you know, your, you know, technical knowledge of how to use a tool, but what you can imagine is possible with it that really gives you power.
Yeah, I think that idea of what's possible that wasn't before, right? How do you ask those in the framework I talked before, how do you ask those sort of abductive questions, those Sherlock Holmes questions? I think that's the most important skill today. And yeah, as more tools become available, it will become increasingly so. I was talking yesterday or on Saturday with Nolan Bushnell, who's the
I've talked to him before,
founder of Atari.
Yeah,
just amazing, amazing guy. He's been involved in founding, I think, something like 100 companies. He's only has 20 or so listed on his Wikipedia, but I think he deducts the failures. The point is, you know, I was talking to him and he's like, it is so weird, right? This is the most technical guy on the planet, right? And he's like, I don't program anymore. I don't have to write code anymore. It's all there. I just click it together. What does that mean? Like, when you don't have to be like a Nolan level technologist to build Nolan level technologies. I mean, that's mind blowing. And that's the world that we're moving into. And that's why we've got to have these bigger picture skills, right? The technology is a democratizing force. And what that means is that the capabilities of people at the next level up are suddenly, you know, devolved. But that also means that the decision-making skills of kings, you know, of global leaders, they now need to be pushed down, you know, deeper into our organizations, deeper into our societies, because with great power, I mean, I'm about to go Spider-Man on this, but with great power comes great responsibility. You know, the fact that you can use a tool doesn't mean that you can use it in the same way, that you can act in the same way that you used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue to getting into the content of the book. But what in the world, you know, in your own career trajectory led you to this perspective? Because like I said, I mean, to me, this was one of the things I knew we would never be able to cover the level of depth that you went into in 1 hour. So, you know, I mean, what's the trajectory that led you to where you're at to writing this book?
So I was the managing partner or CEO of product innovation firms that brought about 350 products to market over the last 25 years. And about 120 of those are still on the market. If you know anything about new product development, that is a statistic that is impossible. It's so good. And so the question became, well, why? What was I doing differently? What were we doing differently? Like, why were we seeing a future that would exist where other people, other competitors weren't? And that's what the book is really about. And it's about, you know, we talked about this personal development cycle. You know, a lot of my career to date has really been about trying to be kind of the rock star, right? Like, how do you become the coolest kid in the room? How do you become the most important person in the room? And I think where it's going and why I wrote this book is a shift in my life to how do I become the host? How do I enable other people to do these things to be more repeatedly successful? Because I think that's the real usefulness that we have in the world as we start to get older. Going back to your question of how do you avoid going insane from perpetually taking bigger risks, it's how do you allow other people to make bigger bets while taking less?
Well, you open the book by saying the collision of 10 rapidly moving economic, technological, and social undercurrents will cause many of this decade's rogue waves. While the scale of their impact is knowable, their energy is now only now rising to the surface. If you want to create your own fate when they hit you, you will need to learn how to spot and track them, have honest conversations about their implications for your business, and position yourself to maximize your resilience and advantage. So can you talk about what those, you know, 10 undercurrents are, and then, you know, for the sake of our audience, define a rogue wave?
Yeah, well, let's start with defining a rogue wave, and then we'll talk about the undercurrents. So you've heard about a black swan, right? These incalculable risks that fall out of nowhere and just destroy everything. The reality, you might have noticed, is that whenever leaders aren't paying attention, they claim it was a black swan, right? The pandemic, that wasn't a black swan event. It was highly knowable. It was increasingly likely. 2008, the financial crash, that wasn't a black swan event. It was highly knowable. It was increasingly likely. September 11th, that wasn't a black swan event. The security establishment was screaming their heads off saying that this was an increasing risk. Whether it was an increasing risk on that day, well, that was a surprise. But whether it was an increasing risk, all of these things were near inevitabilities, and they were near inevitabilities within a certain time frame, and we just weren't paying attention. And so what's a rogue wave, right? If most things aren't black swans, there's something else. And there wasn't a really good word for this idea of compound volatility, these individually manageable waves of change that stack up in a certain time in a certain place to become unmanageable. And that's what a rogue wave is. It's a series of individually manageable trends that stack up to become unmanageable. And we've all experienced these in our lives. You've experienced them in your career. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at the next decade, there are 10 major trends that we lay out in the book that are both highly knowable and highly trackable. And 10's probably too much to talk about in this moment, but they really break down to three categories. Technological change, right? What's going to be the impact of things like artificial intelligence? What's going to be the impact of the increasing cost of producing new semiconductors? And how will things like that shift the nature of technology? And how will they impact the next generation of industries? The second is economic change. So in a country like the United States, the vast majority of the economy is tied to consumption, right? It's tied to consumers. So what does it mean when things like the population inversion that we've recently seen, that the population's getting older. Well, it means that people buy a lot less Jordache jeans or whatever's cool that week, because, you know, when you're 65, that's not cool. They probably buy a lot less houses. They mm-hmm. probably buy a lot less educations. And so that drives that limits the flow of money through the economy. At the same time, they probably pressure people, increasingly pressure the social safety net. The cost of healthcare as a percentage of the economy, of GDP, goes up. And the number of people who are retired versus working goes up. So the size of the tax base for salary goes down. This is a radical change. This is a radical shift, and it's going to impact the future of the United States. And this isn't just happening in the United States. This is happening in all of the 20 largest economies in the world at the same time. So we're going to see a real rethinking of the nature of economics coming out of COVID. We're seeing a change in the social contract, right? And social changes. So if you take a look in the last 2 or 3 years, right? Brexit, the yellow jacket protests in France, the umbrella protests in Hong Kong, the upending of the governance in Chile, where, by the way, the what's called the Gini coefficient, the income disparity, which was one of the major drivers, is about the same as it is in San Francisco Bay Area today, right? So yeah. the out of nowhere, and I was there like the week before talking to government leaders saying, you're going to have social unrest if you don't deal with the number of things. And they looked at me like I had three heads, right? These things, they pop out of nowhere. And these redefinitions of the social contract, they pop out of nowhere. What's happened in Chile is they've had to rewrite the constitution to satisfy the protesters. Mm-hmm. And we'll see if that's enough.
Yeah.
So we're seeing all of these changes happen simultaneously, but we look at them one headline at a time. We've got to look at them in aggregate. We've got to look at that compound volatility as opposed to the individual changes.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you bring up the Gini coefficient, because I remember I did a 6-month study abroad in Brazil when I was in business school. This was 2008. And at that time, I think Brazil had one of the highest Gini coefficients in the world. And I'm pretty sure we're kind of on par with them at this point.
I would imagine it's distributed differently around the country. Yeah. But it's not getting better. And one of the one of the reasons you want to look at these things together as opposed to separately, one of the major reasons that the Gini coefficient is going up in the United States is, you know, as populations get older, parents die. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, 50-year-olds, as we're, you know, 60-year-olds, they suddenly come into tremendous wealth. They end up with two lifetimes of wealth.
Yeah.
You know, especially coming out of COVID with all of the stock market money and everything. And so you end up with people who are older, you know, some who are living in tremendous opulence and some who are living in tremendous poverty. And that's relatively new in this country, that diversity of experience of age.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's get into the entire concept of the Rogue framework. And you know, since I get the privilege of picking your brain, let's use my business as the example, just so I could kind have a tactical and practical takeaway. Because like I said, I think that, you know, one of the things that struck me most was that we got hit by that rogue wave with, you know, the Apple glitch that none of us planned for in Maine. I remember our ad sales team said, Trini, there's nothing we can do until this gets fixed. And it made me really think about, okay, how do you mitigate against that? So let's actually go through this. Like, let's say that we want to apply this framework to the future of Unmistakable and use it to, you know, grow our podcast. And you go into a number of concepts. Let's start with, you know, the reality test.
Yeah. Okay. So if you want to look at any situation, if you want to project the future, the first thing you need to deal with is what's called accumulation error. If you have a wrong assessment, if you're off by 10%, you know, in the first, in your first assessment, and you next year you do it again, and you're off by 10% again, and so on and so forth. You can very quickly be off by 100%, right, in any projection of the future. And so what you want to do is really get down deep and say, okay, well, what is the baseline truth, right? What do we know? What's our foundation here? And the first thing you want to do is figure out what's your reconnaissance method, right? How are you going to understand what you can know, what you can't know, and what you know that you, what you don't know that you can't, right? Mm-hmm. Those are like the first three questions. And the quest, a lot of people like don't really get rigorous about this, and they answer a whole bunch of small, easy questions, but they don't really increase their knowledge or what I call shrink the search area. So the first thing you want to do is ask, like, what is the question that if I answered it would shrink the search area, the number of unknowns the most?
Yeah.
And start there. And then look at, you know, we talked earlier about inductive, abductive, deductive, and Bayesian reasoning. You know, what combination of those different ways of looking at the world? How do I use logic? How do I use probability? And how do I use conjecture, or what's called counterfactuals, to figure out what is that baseline truth? What types of questions am I answering to get down to what is true?
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about your business, right, the first thing I would ask is, okay, so we have this disruption. The most important first question is, what's the shortest and the longest it could last?
Yeah.
Right. And the second is, do I have enough cash flow and do I have enough resilience with my listeners to survive that range? The next question would be, one next question might be, are there ways to, maintain cash flow and to drive listeners to other channels that that will be successful for me? So I'm guessing maybe you didn't have the majority of your listeners on a newsletter.
So that you could push them. Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, because as I was going through my Q4, sort of goal setting, I thought, okay, now there are subscription podcasts available that are ad free, and Substack is one of those places. Like, this could be a way to mitigate that risk in the future.
Yeah. So how do you one of the things we talk about later in the book, and so we're now getting kind of out of that real framework idea, but how do you time sequence and hit? How do you change the order of the events so that you can either by changing the timing, changing the sequencing, or hedging so that you have some kind of counter cyclical bet or investment that'll offset the risk. And so moving toward a subscription basis is really interesting, because it doesn't matter if your people, the healthcare fitness center model is the best idea ever, right? January 1st, everyone's going to lose weight. January 6th, no one ever goes to the fitness center again, but they're being paid for the next 12 months. It's the best business model ever, right? So, if you have some component of that kind of thing to stretch out your cash flow, it's huge.
Let's talk about this whole idea of observe, because it really, I'm not a data scientist or, a market research expert, but the way you talked about, observing systems, looking at higher order effects and really kind of being, intelligent, about the way you do this, one of the things you say is simply gathering information at random and that hoping to make sense of it afterward might work when there are only a few dozen possible solutions, but what if there are hundreds or thousands or millions? And it kind of made me think about, okay, then, what is the right way to interpret, for example, survey data that I collect from my email list?
So let's just pop back to the last thing for a second, because it's going to tie to this. So we talked about in the real framework, there are four steps. There's reality testing. There's evidence collection. There's analyzing the range of options, and then there's assessing likelihood. And we talk about the best practices for doing all of those. And that gets you through, three of the four major ways of knowing, deductive, inductive, abductive. The fourth one is what's called Bayesian reasoning. And it's how do you stack up a range of probabilities? How do you use what's called control systems theory, or every field has a different flavor of this, but how do you use what you can know about how information needs to move from one node to another, whether it's a warehouse or a piece of the economy or components of your supply chain, so that you can figure out earlier on, what will cause the heart attack, right? Mm-hmm. Because some screw up in northern Chengdu, that manufacturer is down, so we know in 3 months we're going to have a problem at Walmart. So there are, that's kind of what I propose is, how do you observe the system? How do you do Bayesian reasoning more effectively? And a lot of it's just kind of stepping back, taking the God view, and saying, okay, well, what do we know about kind of the map of our system? Where are the nodes? Where are the key pieces of where does information collect, or where do goods collect, or where does value collect in our system? And then how does it move, and where does it move to other places in the system? You can really quickly draw diagrams like this, and it's probably the best way of thinking through it. And I wish I had a visual in front of me to share with you, but they're kind of spaghetti diagrams, and there's a bunch of them in the book.
Yeah, I saw
as examples.
Yeah, it made me think I could do a mind map that just had endless amounts of branches off of it.
Yeah, yeah, it can get out of control really quickly, right? And so is a human who's running a small business, you really want to stylize these things. Mm-hmm. And say, okay, well, where are the, stock flow models are a good example that you can find easily on the internet. Yeah. Type in stock flow diagram right now. And you can start to see, you could do this for your business. You could do this for your life. You could do this for your industry. You could do this for your customers, to map out, what does the system look like? And if something changes, right, in that system, what would accelerate, what would decelerate, what would explode? Mm-hmm. We were talking about Nolan Bushnell the other day. Earlier today, and he said something fascinating to me, which is, the Atari 2600 was the first home video game system, and it had these cartridges that you would jack into it. And he was really concerned about getting this out and cost reduction and so on and so forth. So he got this crazy little game thing out, and it was huge at Christmas or whatever. And it became massive, and he ended up with this huge installed base of technology, of this platform. But to save 5 cents, he had decided he didn't want to put two extra pins on the connectivity between the cartridges, which were kind of if you think about it as razors and blades, they were kind of like the razors. They were the replaceable thing. The blades, they were the replaceable thing. And then the Atari 2600 computer, that was that was the razor. That was the thing you bought that was expensive that you kept. Mm-hmm. And because he didn't spend 5 cents on these little pins to connect these two things, is the cost of memory decreased? He wasn't able to put read-write memory on the cartridge. And so he was never able to upgrade the original system. So when you played a game and you took the cartridge out, you couldn't actually put it back in and play the game where you were, yesterday. Or you couldn't put more information on the cartridge or upgrade the whole system by upgrading the cartridges. Moore's law made the cost of computation less expensive and the cost of semiconductors less expensive. Yeah. My point is, if he'd taken that systems level view, he would have seen, if this thing is successful, that 5 cents will mean that my installed base, my Atari 2600s will last for 5 years instead of 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. And so I can actually monetize those in a massive way, because all of these other things are going to change in the system that make where I put my compute, where I put my memory, where I want to put it, different. And we see this repeatedly, right? We build these things. I worked with a company. I mean, we've all worked with companies that are really excited about their new technology. And then Google or Apple comes out and they decide to make it free.
Mm.
Right. And then all of a sudden their world implodes. And yet these are knowable things, right? That a large company with an interest in X, Y, and Z, with a huge platform of all of your customers, will want to make this free. And so how do you respond? We try to avoid getting overwhelmed. And I think one of the real lessons is, you can't protect your ship from everything. More armor doesn't necessarily make you stronger, right? Yeah. You will get overwhelmed. The question is what happens next, right? No matter how high you build the dike in New Orleans, like New Orleans has always flooded. New Orleans will always flood. Mm. The question's what happens next.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of what's happened to Clubhouse. With the minute Clubhouse started to really gain traction, Twitter and Facebook launched audio rooms.
Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah. So let's talk about this idea of generate your future, because I think that the thing that struck me most that you talked about was, you know, not 10x, but 100x thinking. It you know, it made me even rethink, you know, my quarterly goals. I'm like, okay, we got 1,000 podcasts in the archive. You know, and I realized one other thing is when I started to look at it from first principles, I was like, what is this all made of? What are the raw materials? And I came to the conclusion that the raw materials are words. And those raw materials can be repurposed and repackaged in thousands of different ways. And you know, the metaphor that I, you know, came back to was the metaphor of an apple tree that, you know, Julian Smith told me. He said, you can do one of two things with an apple tree. You can sell apples, or, you know, Jason Fried has this great post on the 37 Signals blog about selling your byproducts. And if you have an apple tree, inevitably there's going to be byproducts, you know, which could be selling apples to Whole Foods to, you know, let them bake apple pies to, you know, a vodka company to make apple vodka. And it just made me realize it's like the person who recognized the byproducts of their system can extract far more value out of that system.
Well, there's I live up near Napa in the wine country in California. And when the fires hit out here last year or the year before, most of the wine growers, they tossed their grapes. I mean, they were smoky. They weren't worth anything. One of them said, hey, what about smoky cognac? That'd be amazing. So they took their off grapes and they turned them into this incredibly desirable thing. I think about my friend's family farm in Ohio. And one of the things they do is they've got this, they do this dining series, or at least pre-COVID they did. And they take basically extra produce, you know, from the farm, right? Say there'd been too much asparagus, right? And they'd figure out how to just do amazing things with asparagus. And then they'd take the scraps from that dinner and they would use it to feed the pigs. And then the pigs would be part of the, you know, part of the next dinner. And so they had this complete cycle where there was almost zero waste. It was just unbelievable what was going on there. And so I think we need to start thinking more ecologically, right? We were talking about observing your system, right? How do you really look at that system and say, okay, where are those opportunities? Where can we, you know, if they aren't available within the ecosystem today, can we build them out? Can we create them? Mm-hmm. And I think most importantly, you know, how do we have a back of pocket plan, right? When we know, like, the one thing we know is that we will get overwhelmed, right? What happens next? And not necessarily how do you have it all planned out, right? But how do you have a back of pocket plan for dealing with that? When I think about the French at the end of World War I, Maginot, who was the defense minister, he was obsessed that the Germans would not invade over the German border again. And he builds out what's called the Maginot Line, which is this massive berm that goes from Switzerland, you know, to Luxembourg, I believe, and tries to keep the Germans out. And it was really effective at doing that. The Germans didn't really attack the Maginot Line. They just went around it.
Mm-hmm.
And what would have been the better answer? For the cost of building this massive fortification, they could have bought 5,000 tanks, literally put a tank every 300 feet across their entire border with Germany. And when the Germans moved, they could have moved 5,000 tanks. That would have been a much more effective strategy. Mm. And so the question is, you know, not only how do you defend yourself, how do you increase your armor? But how do you increase your flexibility when the world doesn't do what you expect it to?
Yeah. So I think you kind of touched on the whole idea of, you know, in some way uncoupling from threats. But one of the things I wondered about, you know, on threats was this whole idea of trigger points, because I think the thing that struck me most, probably another quote that really stood out, was this idea of looking for small changes that lead to exponential results.
Right.
And I thought about that in terms of, okay, if I'm looking through podcast download data, or if I'm just looking at the business general, like, where are those in my own business? How do I find those?
I think it goes back to this idea of building a systems model of your organization, right? We talked about stock flow diagrams. There are lots of other variations of this, in this whole world of what's called control systems theory. There's a guy named Jay Forrester that you can look up who kind of founded a lot of this stuff. And I think that's a really good way to start looking at your situation, right? How do you stop looking at the mountains from ground level, and how do you start looking at it from God view and understanding that the larger dynamic at play? And once you do that, you know, you can start to see the Rube Goldberg system that's in front of you. And you can start to figure out, okay, well, why does, you know, this thing keeps, you know, going off and then causing everything else to happen. But, you know, the world is not a perpetual motion machine, right? So we know that energy came from somewhere. Where up the system did it come from? And what can we know about that? What can we know about what that trigger is? You know, whether it's, you know, you take a look at the automotive industry. What we hear in the news all the time right now is, oh, the semiconductors. And they're driving the cost of automobiles. They're limiting the amount that can be produced. In 2012, Toyota got hit by the Daiichi nuclear power plant, the Fukushima disaster, and it upended their supply chain. And these are the biggest, baddest, leanest manufacturers on the planet. I mean, these guys invented agile manufacturing. They invented, you know, just in time. They like you think that, you know, the lean software companies are lean. These guys were doing it in the 70s. And they looked at the system and they said, this is crazy, right? Why is like some widget from, you know, Fukushima, like, why is that upending our global supply chain? What are the, you know, limited number of components that we need to have in buffer, right? So that we can continue to produce when a disaster hits. And one of those things that they identified was semiconductors. So they bought a 6-month supply of semiconductors, and they didn't actually purchase them. I think this is important to realize. In many cases, what they did was they found a third party who was willing to buy them. They contracted guaranteeing they would buy them within a certain time period, but they didn't have to hold them in inventory, and it wasn't really a cost aside from a couple percentage points, you know, of interest. And so in 2016, when Taiwan, which is where many of the world's semiconductors are produced, got hit by a natural disaster, Toyota floated straight through many of the other companies on the planet. They were deeply impacted by this. When COVID hit, you know, many of the other companies were decimated by the semiconductor issues that were caused by COVID in Taiwan. Toyota, they had a bad year like everybody else, but they floated straight through, and they actually became the largest automotive manufacturer on the planet, I believe, last year as a result of this. So, you know, I think that the lesson here is, you know, what are those trigger points, and what are the small decisions you can make, you know, a period of time before that allow you to take advantage of those when everybody else is capsized just trying to bail out their boat, right? Because at the end of the day, that's your blue ocean, right? That's your opportunity. It's not in the good times when you're fighting for percentage points. The real opportunity is in the bad times when everyone else is trying to bail out their boat, and you're sailing and there's a lot of wind.
Yeah.
That's when you want to play.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it was in Scott Galloway's book. He actually talked post corona. He talked about how some of the, you know, biggest businesses and major moments in history were all, you know, moments following a crisis.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you take a look at how Amazon and Zoom have done this year, right?
Yeah. Like,
why did Microsoft not capture all of the voice market, right? And the teleconference market? I mean, they had the contracts, they had the technology, they had the sales teams, they had the government relations to scale this globally. Like, why was it that Zoom took the cake?
Nah.
I think there's a lot of lessons there about how to think systemically about these systems and how to put them in place when the opportunity comes. Yeah. You think about World War II, right? Like World War I and World War II. The U.S. wasn't really a significant player, but they came in late with excess capacity and they took the cake. You know, the reason that we've had such a great century after World War II is really because everybody else decided to bomb themselves into oblivion and we just took their debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know you got to get going. So let's finish with this whole idea of experiments, because I, you know, when I was thinking about experiments, like, okay, you know, typically what do we do as online marketers? We, you know, run A/B tests, we, you know, change copy. So what does that look like for people like us who are running these sort of smaller businesses or, you know, like media properties?
Yeah. So what we've been secretly talking about through this whole episode is what's called the rogue method. So how do you our reality tests? How do you O, observe a system? How do you G, generate the range of possible futures? How do you uncouple your threats from your opportunities? And then how do you E, how do you create a portfolio of experiments? And I think mm-hmm. one of the things that really many companies fail at is thinking about their investments in the future in the right way. When you think about a company like General Motors, you can argue whether they're innovative or not, but I can tell you when you take a look at their investment spend over the last 100 years, they're an innovative company. And they made a better car, a better car, a better car, a better car. Maybe not the best car, but a better car. Until one day, they made an electric vehicle that goes 140,000 miles without a tune-up. And Mary Barra, the woman behind that, is now the CEO. This is a problem because their entire business is built on selling a car to a dealer who makes their free cash flow by maintaining that car for 3 years and then selling a new car to that same customer every 3 years. The only problem with this is when you sell a car and you don't see the customer for a decade because the car doesn't need a tune-up, this entire business model implodes. And so what do you do about that? You should have, a decade ago, 15 years ago, been looking at a portfolio of experiments, right? How do you create the right combination of high risk, medium risk, and low risk experiments, or high, medium, and low payoff experiments, just like you would your investment portfolio, so that no matter what happens, you're getting the right payoffs at the right time, the right combination of payoffs. And so no one individual thing that you're doing is going to define your success or your failure, right? So if your financial model is based exclusively on podcasts and all of a sudden podcasts go to free, or all of a sudden someone comes into your space and, you know, Reid Hoffman comes into your space and says, I've got $100 million and, you know, 4 trillion followers and thanks. You know, what's your plan B? How do you take advantage of that? So when I came into COVID, you know, I had a back of pocket idea. I was, I'd been an executive at HP. I was working as an advisor, for board advisor for a number of organizations. And I was making most of my money actually as a public speaker. I'd backfilled once I left HP, I'd backfilled my, most of my executive salary public speaking, crazily enough. The world was frothy back in 2019. But I knew that there was going to be a financial crash. And I wrote a book. It was initially called After the Crash. It's now called Rogue Waves, conveniently. And I brought it to publishers in 2019. And they said, nah, that's not going to happen. You know, the world's not going to get upended like that. But I had that in the back of my pocket. So in 2020, when chaos hit, I was the person who was able to walk into the room and say, here's the book you're looking for today. Because I knew, you know, I didn't know what day chaos was going to hit, but I knew that my speaking business would be impacted. And that would be the very moment when people would want exactly that book. And so I created a situation where I'd been doing experiments, I'd been making investments that were countercyclical so that they balanced each other out. And I think that's one of the really important lessons when we start thinking about growth in our companies, not how do we grow the thing we have, but how do we make sure that we have a large enough, a diverse enough garden that no matter what happens, no matter what the year, we're going to have bounty.
Wow. Well, like I told you from having read the book, this is a really deep rabbit hole that we could go down for hours. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Clarity. Clarity of intent. So I had, I first learned this, I first noticed this at, missing the fellow's name. So sorry about that, but there's a Japanese sculptor and he had a museum in New York and I looked at Osamu Noguchi and I looked at his sculptures and I hadn't really understood them. And then I went to the museum and I saw these sculptures in the context, right? And they were placed, they were designed, they were built, they were placed so that not only did they make sense in the context of the room, but they were distinctive in the context of the massive blue wall that was across the street, hiding a salvage yard. And this red sculpture, this reddish sculpture against that blue background, it snapped. And what I realized there was the clarity of his intent, right? He had designed that thing not to look good in a photograph, not to look good in another museum. He had designed it to look good, to be distinctive in that museum at that place, at that time. And it blew my mind. And so the question, when you take a look at the world, when you look at how to be unmistakable, is what's the context? And that's really what my book's about. How do you make sense? How do you be distinctive? How do you take advantage of change, of the new reality that you're going to be in tomorrow?
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, the book, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
This is so fantastic. Thank you for having me. You can find me. The best place is on LinkedIn. Follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I push out. I write for Forbes, Fast Company, Inc. A broad range of publications. That's the fastest place to find me. And my website is jonathan@jonathanbrill.com. You can find me there if you want to email me and continue the conversation. I love chatting with interesting people.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys and download your free copy.